audiences for your musical tours, do they differ much from the stand-up comedy audience?
Well, obviously there's an initial difference that they've made the conscious decision to come see you rather than just gone to an comedy club. Because that's the difference between a comedy club audience and a tour audience, right there, the immediate difference is, you go to a comedy club audience, yeah, sometimes they'll specifically come to see me, but not often. By and large, they'll just, you know, and even then, it will only be a very small fraction of the audience who specifically come to see me. Most of them will just be out for the night, it's a comedy club, who's on, never heard of him, don't matter, let's go, it'll probably be okay. Whereas when you go on tour, it's your name on the poster, you're the only guy who's on, they are there to see you. So from that respect, tour audiences are easier. Getting a tour audience is much, much harder. Because if you play a decent comedy club, the comedy club's got any kind of reputation, it'll sell out whether or not you're on. It doesn't make any difference. But they're not necessarily your audience. So while getting them into the building is not your problem, it's actually a harder job for you to entertain them once they're there, because they might not specifically want to see you. Whereas a tour audience, they've made a conscious decision to see you, so you're already winning, but the trick is getting them to turn up in the first place.
You might start with only three.
Yeah, you might, exactly, so that's the thing. But one thing about my audiences is it's very difficult to generalize them about them, because I do get the most bewildering blend of people coming to see me, which I love. I love, I just get the most insane demographic coming to see me, because on the one hand, because I'm on Radio 4, you do get quite a few very respectable sort of middle-aged couples will turn up because they know me on Radio 4. I'm on before the Archers, you know what I mean? So they will turn up for that. But then you'll get teenage goths who see me at the Leeds Festival. You know, or you'll get students who have played their uni, or you know, you might get people who've seen me on the Paramount Channel. You know, when they've been getting in pissed at 2 a.m. because I've done all those stand-up shows. I've done the comedy show twice. I've done Live at Jongleurs once. I've done World Stands Up twice, and those are all on a loop on the Paramount Channel. So I will come round on one or the other of them about once every 6 weeks. That's one of the reasons that Rubber Woman went back into the set after about 5 years, and this is my song for about 5 years, but it's, I do it on the Comedy Store set that gets played the most often. And as such, it's actually become possibly one, well, certainly one of my top three best known songs. So that's why it went back into the set, because if nothing else, you do it at the top. The audience don't know it so well that there's no point singing it. It's not like they remembered every word, but a lot of it will sort of re-establish in the mind, oh, I've seen this bloke on the telly, and you'd be amazed how many brownie points that gets you right from the off. Because one thing I will say, when I've done gigs with big TV comics who are coming back to do club gig, the woman at the tour or something and everything, it is bizarre the way the reception that they get. Yeah, obviously they're good, because they wouldn't have got where they are if they weren't good, but the reception they get is totally out of proportion. All proportion to how good they are. All proportion to how good they are. And you know, you look at the audience and they are in absolute paroxysms of mirth, and you think, well, this is all good stuff, but if it was being said by anybody other than him, you'd just be laughing and then moving on, you know. And it's something like the audience, it's all about how much confidence they have in you, I suppose. And the minute you're on, if you're the guy off the telly, they assume you're brilliant because you're the guy off the telly. So bizarrely, by putting Rubber Woman back in at the top of the set, it kind of bumps me up a little notch. You think, oh, it's that bloke off that thing. So instantly I'm winning, you know.
So I emceed Ardal O'Hanlon just after we finished My Hero last November or something. He's going directly into filming whatever he's doing now. And he was doing a mini tour. And he was trying out new material. So he had the hour to himself to do the whole, and the place was packed, and I thought, poor bugger, because he's a really nice person, really, and he obviously is very famous, but the audience expectations had to be higher than the material he was trying out, and I was like, very brave to go out there and try and achieve that. I mean, he was good, but I knew that probably,
but
they do, you know,
give you the benefit of the doubt to an extraordinary extent. I remember one time I did a club gig, one of the last club gigs Harry Hill ever did. It was a big club which didn't last very long, but they did that thing of getting calling your favours in from a couple of heavy hitters for the first night. So it was me, Dave Gorman, and Harry Hill opened this club for the first time. I see Harry come on, and he literally went for the first minute and a half. Thinking, Harry, you have earned the right to spend the first minute and a half going but I think pull that shit at the creek on a Sunday, see how bloody long you last if you're anybody other than Harry Hill, because it's fine, you know, Harry Hill's allowed to go of course he's brilliant, for God's sake, you can't take it away from him. As we said, that TV burp thing, this is the funniest thing on, which is weird because I hate clip shows and I've never really liked much of the things that
but with him, it's not about the clips.
It's not about the clips,
him,
no.
Which is much better.
Yeah.
So going back a bit, so there you are on the grass market, 2 or 3 years, focusing away, beginning to get into creating songs, which are, you know, what, it's not really parody, is it? It's versions of, or I prefer the version you use, the songs that they've created.
A song of theirs that you've never heard before. Well, the thing is, that really sort of impetus behind that really kicked in 99 when I got taken on the Now Show on Radio 4. And that's the point at which my output went berserk, and it's been berserk ever since, because on the back of doing the Now Show, I got taken on the Bad Week, which is on Radio 2, similar kind of show with Pod and Dennis again on Radio 2, and then after doing that for about 3 or 4 years, I got given my own show on Radio 4, and so basically I'm writing over 100 songs a year these days, because when I'm doing the Bad Week, I'll write 3 songs a show. Now Show, I write 3 songs a show. Bad Week, I write 2 songs a show. When I'm doing my show, and admittedly, we only do one short run a year, but I'm writing 5 songs a show, you know. And that's above and beyond just other little commissions I get.
Last week, you said you wrote 7.
Last week, I wrote 7 because I was doing the last word on More 4 at very short notice. They just called me in with about 3 or 4 days to go because they were doing the comedy version of the last word, playing by Mark Dolan, who's another guy who did improv at Edinburgh Uni, so I've known him for years. I got called in the last minute to write an song per show for that. So I wrote 4 songs for that, and it was the last week of the last series of the Now Show. So I wrote 3 songs for that as per usual. So I ended up writing 7 songs a day and pretty much giving myself an aneurysm. So that's the point at which my output went nuts. And also in 2003, I put the band together, which ostensibly was kind of off the back. I did an album in 2002, which was kind of recordings, by and large, of songs I've written for the Now Show, Bad Week, such as it was called Radio Face. But we did a fair bit of production on it, you know, layered everything up, multi-tracked everything, and put quite a lot of sort of sequencing and programming on it. So it ended up being an album of which I couldn't really play that much live myself. So we put the band together, it was slightly with a view to being able to tour that album properly, but actually once the band was together, it took us off in a whole other direction again, because the band Kirsty and Tash, they're so damn good and so quick on the uptake, and they're so diverse and versatile that I started to write to sort of, you know, push them a bit. I started to write to their strengths, and also we started writing kind of stuff that was almost a Frank Zappa kind of story. You know, Frank Zappa would occasionally do something that was incredibly ludicrously complicated, but we actually be quite funny purely because of how complicated it was. So I started to write that kind of thing. Like, as a song, we did the Interactive song, where basically it's a song where every verse is in a different style and somebody, and it's a different joke, but every verse is actually a self-contained joke, you know. So one's a one-line, one's a bit of slapstick, one's a pun, you know, one's a bit of satire, you know. And you know, there's a song called Tea Party, which is basically my drug opus, where it's about ingesting loads of different drugs, and every time you take a new drug, the sound changes. So when you get stoned, it sort of turns into dumb reggae, and then you sort of drop acid, and it goes all swirly and psychedelic, and then you drop E, and it suddenly goes all pop and, you know, sort of underworld, you know, and that's the idea. So, and I started to write that kind of thing for this, you know, because we can just switch styles every verse.
Where did you find them?
They found them slightly complicated process. Photographer mate of mine, Mike Pryor, he is a mate of a guy called Tony Moore, who used to run a thing called the Cashmere Club in Baker Street, which is now sort of camping out in the Bedford where the Banana Cabaret is, because they lost that venue, which is a shame, because it's a lovely little cellar bar in Baker Street. There was sort of this songwriters collective, basically, and we were looking about 3 years ago now with a view to maybe starting to play my stuff in music venues to see if we could cross it over a bit, because it's something that started to dawn on me about 3 years ago, is that a lot of this is down to context, and you look at somebody like, you know, there are guys who are sort of regarded as legitimate songwriters who write stuff that's every bit as funny as the stuff I do, but it's all about the context they're doing it. They're regarded as a proper music act. Like Neil Hannon, a lot of Neil Hannon stuff is hilarious, you know what I mean? And it's out-and-out comedy songs, but because he's doing it in a sort of a musical context, you know. And, you know, Jarvis Cocker, a lot of what Jarvis Cocker wrote is hysterically funny, you know. And we're just saying, well, let's see if we can actually expand this a bit, so it can actually be sort of taken, not seriously, because that's the wrong word, but give it accreditation, if you like, as a music performer, but beyond the comedy thing. Or if nothing else, just find myself being shunned and ignored in two different places, you know, being sort of despised by the comedy world for playing music, and despised by the music world for trying to be funny, whatever, we're trying to, you know, have the worst of both worlds, why the hell not. We asked Tony if we could do a couple of gigs at sort of like these songwriters evenings at the Cashmere, and we said it, and I'm apropos of not much, because we already had in the back of our minds that maybe it might be fun to put a band together at some point. Just said, do you know any musicians who might be interested in getting involved in something like this? And Kirsty had just left this band she's in. Kirsty's an incredible musician, incredible keyboard player, great bass player, great singer, has the best musical mind of anybody I've ever encountered. And so we met Kirsty and had a bit of a jam. So she's fantastic. She's definitely in if she wants me. And of course, having a female voice in the band opens you up to all kinds of new possibilities. And we said to her, well, do you know anybody else who might be interested in coming? And she said, well, I'm probably persuade Tash to play the drums. I thought, oh, the drummer's a girl as well. This is even better, you know.
And they're both gorgeous.
Yeah, well, they're not a nerd. And the thing is, well, I just like it because it wasn't conceived as a gimmick, but it's become a gimmick. And now that it is a gimmick, I'm more than happy to exploit it as such. But also, it's just a nice inversion of a cliche, isn't it? You're always getting bands of ugly musos with one hot chick standing at the front of it. So I just thought it would be quite nice to have a band of hot chicks with one ugly musician standing in the front. You know, it'd be quite nice to flip it around like that. And so, you know, and then you got the band, and then about the same time I put the band together, my Radio 4 thing, Crimes Against Music, got commissioned properly. So immediately we included the band in there, and then, you know, that obviously, because Crimes Against Music is a show about music, that obviously lends itself very specifically to the sort of the artist parody kind of thing, you know, so that again was an additional impetus to write more of those. And although bizarrely we find actually that they work better live than on record. On the last album, Crimes Against Music, we only put a couple on, and not that many of them are actually specifically reliant on them being a parody of a specific artist in order for the joke to work, because what we discovered is while those tend to go over absolutely gobsmackingly live, because people are quite impressed that you can just pull all these sounds out of the bag just standing there, you know, the same few musicians can sound like, you know, Elton John 1 minute, sound like Duran Duran the next minute, sound like Iron Maiden the next minute, whatever, you know what I mean? Because if you're doing these things on a record, people assume that you have the resources to get these sounds. So it's, while it's still fun, it's not as impressive on record. So, for example, we've got a Duran Duran song, which is an absolute live staple, but it's never been on any of the records. And to be quite honest, I'm not entirely sure if it ever will be, because I'm not sure how we would contextualise it, you know. But so that's kind of what we're up to at the moment. The band's been on tour twice. We toured last year and the year before that. We've got last album. And, of course, last year we also put the single out. We put Everything Sounds Like Coldplay Now out. While the single itself didn't make much of an impact, what did make an impact was we made a video for it and put that up on the net. And that does seem to have changed people's attitudes to the act, because I genuinely haven't ever really thought about TV much. And that sounds kind of sour grapes, or maybe I'm trying to do some kind of coddy's argument. Oh, I never did television, I'm not interested in television. You know, it's not that at all. It's just that very busy with everything I have got on the go, and also looking at the kind of thing which has been in vogue on TV on and off the past few years, think, yeah, but what would you possibly do with me in that? There's very little going on TV that I can see how they could incorporate what I do, and certainly I've not really felt that I have in any kind of, you know, the necessary connections or profile to really get any idea of mine on the telly, and also any idea I have which is going to be completely at odds with the kind of thing which people are doing right now. You know, you just think, well, nobody would be interested in that. But the video seems to change people's minds about it, and so that's
might open a
few minds to the possibility of doing something visual based on what I do. Obviously, we'd have to be very careful about the format, because you could make a complete pig too of it.
How do you choose who you're going to do next? Like when last week when you had to write 5 songs,
yeah.
Did they give you a spec and say we're going to be covering these topics?
With an hour show, the trick is just not to write about the same story that everybody else is writing about. What I tend to sometimes do is take a step back until they've all got the best stories, because oftentimes the stories which make good songs are not necessarily the stories which make good routines, and this is particularly the case with It's Been a Bad Week, because with It's Been a Bad Week, while it's still topical, it tends to be about wacky little news items rather than the big stuff. It tends to be about the quirkies. It tends to be about, man eaten by turtle, you know what I mean? It's that kind of thing.
Microwave cats.
Yeah, microwave cats, that kind of stories, you know, skateboarding dogs and that kind of thing. And the thing is, I find it very difficult to say anything amusing about a news story that's already funny. Mm. Because in order to set the song up, I've got to tell you what the news story is, and the news story is funny, then I've already told you the joke. Mm. Do you see what I mean? Mm. So for me then to sing a song about it, I'm just kind of reiterating, I'm kind of repeating myself. So what I often find is better is find a news story that in and of itself isn't that funny, and just try and come up with a sort of a comment upon it, you know. So
and what about for the live work, when you're doing live work, because you want that to have some longevity?
Every now and again, a song that you write for one of these things accidentally acquires a bit of longevity. Maybe if you're addressing your subject matter in sufficiently vague terms, that the song is still funny or relevant once the news story it was based on has faded from memory.
Well, I'm thinking of like Crap Shag. Where did that come from?
Crap Shag, that predates. Oh, no, I actually knew that on this day. So that predates all of this. That I wrote that in about literally about 97 when I was just basically trying to build up a body of songs so that I could have a decent act which didn't depend at all on rewording other people's tunes. Because so 96, 97 is when I really started devoting my attention to that. And I wrote a lot of the stuff which I'm still doing now because it actually turned out to be the best stuff for the stand-up act I wrote in that kind of period, so 96, 97. So Crap Shag was just... There was a song that I wrote with a mate of mine, which was a kind of a reworded parody of Why Do Fools Fall in Love. And I've kind of... And what I realised that what made it work was the fact that it was a list. The song was a list. It was just sort of enumerated a list of sort of horrible things. And I thought, right, what we need to do is write a song which has an original tune, but a similar kind of approach. We need a song that's another list. And that was what Crap Shag was, because certainly once you get into the chorus, it is just basically a catalogue of sexual incompetence. It's just a long list of things that people get wrong during sex, or the horrible things that people do during sex. So, in that respect, it works very well as a stand-up piece, because it's just basically a series of gags with a tune.
Did people come up, did you get some very odd comments when people came up to you after the show about that song?
Well, I mean, it became a sort of little theme tune of mine.
Did any girls come up and decide to help you?
No. I think they may just take me at my word and decide that I was past redemption and just give me a wide berth. It is funny that whole sort of, do you get cracked onto a kick? So I remember having this conversation with Meryl O'Rourke once, where we basically came to the conclusion that I never get chatted up before I've been on stage, and she never gets chatted up after she's been on stage. She says she gets cracked onto on her way up because she's sort of like, you know, quite a small, cute chick, but you know, once she's been on, they all say, whoa, scary psycho comedian bitch. Whereas I am just hairy fat guy. But once I've been on stage, somehow I'm sort of, hey, quite witty, incredibly talented, hairy fat guy, let's go and buy him a drink, you know what I mean? So it is weird, you do get, you know, I remember advising Stefano Paolini and all this, because at the time he had a girlfriend, so what do I do? So I'll just surf it, you don't actually have to do anything about it, just let it wash over your ego and leave you with a nice warm glowing feeling, then zip it up and go home, you don't actually have to do it. So, but it is weird, the whole gag hag thing.
I find it fascinating.